So you made it through your first day. Congratulations. This practice is so simple. Just pay attention to your breath and pay attention to your body. You know, it's so simple that sometimes it's hard to see how it might work. I know that's a problem that I had for much of my practice, not having faith in the Dharma. And really, it really boils down to paying attention, and paying attention to the sensations in your body. There's a famous quote from the Buddha where he says, "It is in this fathom-long body, endowed with perception and mind, that I proclaim the world, the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the way leading to the cessation of the world." That's a lot, just to get from your body. That's a lot. So I was working on my talk this afternoon. I really wasn't very happy with it. It was kind of boring. I didn't like the topic. So Bonnie came by and talked to me. I hadn't seen Bonnie, we hadn't seen each other in person since December of 2019 at IMS, yeah. And so it's so nice after a pandemic to see real people, not just images on Zoom. So we spent a lot of the time talking. And we started talking about citta. She mentioned citta last night, which is that intuitive knowing that we can get. It's kind of the opposite of the ego. And she said, "You'll come up with the topic, have faith in citta." And she said, ask citta what you should talk about. So I did. And the answer was to talk about faith and citta and my own experience with those two things. So first I'd like to ask, how many of you can say that you have faith in the Dharma? Raise your hand. That's good. That's a lot. That's a lot. You know, I started out on a retreat here. My first retreat was in 1999. It was a three-day retreat like this one. I'm like, I'm going to knock this out. I'm going to get this. I'm going to have an experience. It's one of the worst experiences of my life. It was horrible because I pushed and my ego pushed and there was no room for citta. And I lived a great deal of my life like that. I like to tell people that my first faith was science. My father was a biologist and some of my early memories, sitting next to him on the sofa, probably in kindergarten, reading a book on evolution. He hated religion and would argue with the Jehovah's Witnesses when they came to the door. But, you know, I understand why he did that. His parents had been held as prisoners of war of the United States, along with Geronimo, for decades, and they were indoctrinated into Christianity. They were very faithful Christians. And my dad hated that. All of his siblings did too. And I really took that on. That was my faith in science, in only believing those things that you can measure. So spirituality didn't have a lot of room in my belief system. But dad died in 1991, and a few years after he died, I did something he wouldn't have done. And I've never admitted this, I don't think. I went to see an astrologer. I had some roommates and they were like, you should get your chart done. It's only $3. I'm like, oh, that's bull. I don't believe in that. But I did for fun. And the lady at the checkout register, I was in Seattle at the time, she looked at it and said, "Ooh, you're going to have a big year." I was intrigued. So I went to have a reading. It was really interesting because the first thing the astrologer told me about was my past lives. I just didn't really know what to make of that. She also told me I needed to open my heart. I needed to be in touch with my citta. I didn't really think much of that either. And then she gave me two other pieces of information, one of which I heeded and one of which I did not. The one I didn't heed was to quit drinking coffee. But the one I did heed was to start meditating. So a few years later, I moved down to San Francisco and discovered there was a place that taught meditation. And that place was Spirit Rock. Came down for a day long and tried practicing. But it didn't really work for me. Most of my experiences, they weren't as bad as the first retreat, but they were very difficult. Didn't work. And then I was working in the dot-com business in the internet, and the internet bubble happened, and I lost my job. And I went back to Oklahoma, where I was born, to explore my heritage. Because although I'm just under half Apache, I was raised away from the tribe. And I had this inkling, this thought that maybe, and this is not part of the talk, but maybe my life had been shaped by intergenerational trauma that arose from the imprisonment of my grandparents. So I went back and I got elected chairman of my tribe in 2002. But I stayed connected to Spirit Rock. And every year I'd come back. I went through the Dedicated Practitioners Program and the Community Dharma Leaders Program. That's where I met Bonnie. And I would come here, but I would come here and nothing would happen. And my teacher, Eugene Cash, would ask me, you know, is your life better than it was when you weren't meditating? It was. It was better. You know, but I didn't get that light. I didn't see the light. And it was very frustrating. I can remember sitting here, looking around the room, thinking, this is all a bunch of cultural appropriation. These white people that started this meditation place, you know, they just have all these icons from Asia. It's not even theirs. See, I had the opposite of faith. I had a hindrance, the most difficult hindrance to deal with, which is doubt. So in Buddhism, faith, the word for faith is sadhana. And it's often described that you can have bright faith, which is when you first meditate, you have a great experience, things really work. And boom, I love Buddhism. I love the practice. Some people have that, and I really admire that. And then there's revealed faith, faith that comes after struggles, and you start to realize, hey, this thing is working for me. It's working for me. So I kept coming back, very stubborn. I wanted to make it happen. And in 20 years after I started practicing, I was halfway through the Spirit Rock Teacher Training Program. And I just stepped down from being the chairman of my tribe. That was a huge change. And I came here on a retreat for the month of March. And I sat. And after 25 days, something happened. I was walking into the dining hall, and I actually was sitting down in the dining hall. And it was like this wave of love engulfed me. It was the most incredible thing I'd ever felt. I felt like I was in the presence of the divine. I bowed to it in my heart, in my mind. And I couldn't tell the story of this for 6 months without crying, just from the power of this. You know, one other thing which I'll reveal is that I'm in 12-step program. I never got past the second step, because the third step is you have to believe in a power greater than yourself. I mean, I wasn't an atheist like my dad, but I was agnostic. I couldn't bring myself to believe in something, in a power. But just like that, boom, it happened. And I was able to proceed through the steps, and my practice increased greatly. And it was really helped my teaching. So I still didn't really think a whole lot about citta or have a lot of faith in citta. In fact, I thought about talking about citta because Bonnie has said good things about it, and I've heard a lot about it. And I looked it up, and citta just basically means the mind, I believe, in the definitions. And there are many different modifications for the mind or mind states. So the generic word for citta is the mind. But what we're talking about here is an intuitive knowing. It's a following your heart. And I'd like to digress for a moment and share with you something I read just this year in this book I just got called The Extended Mind. And this extended mind is a chapter called Thinking with Sensations. And she talks about, the author talks about a financial trader on Wall Street named John Coates. He'd worked at Merrill Lynch and Goldman Sachs and Deutsche Bank. And he watched it happen over and over again, she says. Here's the quote from him. Using my best analytical efforts, drawing on my education. He has a PhD in economics from Cambridge. Drawing on my education and a wide reading of economic reports and statistics, he would devise a brilliant trade, one that was impeccable in its logic and unassailable in its reasoning, and it would lose money every time. And there were other occasions equally puzzling. Quote, I would catch a glimpse with peripheral vision of another possibility, another path into the future. It showed up as a mere blip in my consciousness, a momentary tug on my attention, but it was a flash of insight. Coupled with a gut feeling that gave it the imprimatur of the highly probable, when he obeyed these gut feelings, Coates found, he was usually rewarded with a profitable outcome. Against all his assumptions, all his training, Coates was forced to arrive at an unconventional conclusion. Good judgment may require the ability to listen carefully to feedback from the body. And he goes on to say that traders who don't have any formal education are often much more successful than the Ivy League educated stars who rely on analytics, and they just don't make any good trades. And he was so moved by this, he actually left Wall Street and started studying it. And they looked into this phenomenon, and they went to London, studied traders on the London trading floor. And they would ask the traders, can you feel your heartbeat? And what they found was is that the traders that could feel their heartbeat were much more successful than those that could not. And another quote from him, he says, our research suggests that signals from the body, the gut feelings of financial lore, contribute to success in the markets. Well, that's what the whole team, he was there with the team in London, the research team. So this awareness of the inner state of the body that can tell us how to live in the world. This fathom-long body, as the Buddha said, it can proclaim the world, the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the way leading to cessation of the world. So when you pay attention to your breath and you feel your body breathing, and your mind drifts off and you're daydreaming about something you love or something you hate or something you want, or what you're going to do when you get back home. And then when you come back and you reconnect to that sensation, you're reconnecting to the possibility of touching into a place of knowing that the science that I knew can't explain. A place of knowing that can lead us to make decisions and live in the world in a way that can help our lives. So, she says that there are, in our internal organs, there are these nerves, and they bring sensations from our muscles, even our bones, into part of the brain called the insula, which gives you the feeling of how I feel in the moment. So that gut feeling that you have is something to heed, and it's a real feeling. And when you can practice and allow your ego to drop away and touch into that feeling of how I feel, how does my body feel? And for me, that's how the practice works. So not only can this practice make you calm, it can make you rich if you're on Wall Street. So there's just a couple of things at the end here I want to read. She says, differences to sensitivity to internal signals may be influenced by genetic factors as well as by the environments in which we grew up, including the communications we receive from caregivers about how we should respond to our bodily prompts. And as a person who spent 20 years in Indian country, I can tell you that often natives have difficult home lives and they may not get the feedback from a parent on how they should respond to their prompts. We can become detached from our body. But this practice, if you have that, if you've had that, you don't have to be native to have that. If you're detached from your body, and that happens when you're traumatized, this practice can bring you back in tune, can reconnect you with what's really happening, so you can have a clear seeing of what's going on. So she says it gives you knowledge about ourselves, about other people, and the worlds through which we move. Again, the world, the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the way leading to the cessation of the world. So a lot of what I talked to Bonnie about was how my move came about, because I recently made a move from Oklahoma, where I'd been living since 2001, to a canyon in southeast Arizona called the Cochise Stronghold. I mentioned that last night. As a way of description, if you think of the road leading in the Spirit Rock, this is kind of like a box canyon in a way. The road ends and there are hills on three sides. That's what it's like. But the road's about 2 miles long. And if you think about the hillside above Spirit Rock, it's about 1,000 feet above where we are. There's a hillside about 1,000 feet above my house, but all the dirt has eroded away. All the dirt is gone. And it leaves these great big granite cliffs, these huge granite boulders. And it's an amazing, incredible place. And our tribe, the Fort Sill Apache tribe, owns land in this canyon. So during my tenure as chairman, I went there a few times, but I never really understood the power of the canyon until just recently. It's a great place, and it's very meaningful to our people. We had a couple of reservations in the West that were closed, and they were removed and moved to another reservation, and then finally made prisoners of war and taken to Florida and Alabama and then Oklahoma. So it has meaning as a former reservation, but it didn't have a really deep, strong meaning until around 2009 also. I don't know if you know Donald Rothberg, the teacher here, but he loves things like that. And he was in Tucson teaching at the Tucson Community Meditation Center. And I went out to see him. He was one of my mentors, has been one of my mentors. And he wanted to see the stronghold. So we drove out there and climbed up the cliffs. And there was a caretaker that watched the tribe's land there. He took us up one of the trails and saw some petroglyphs and paintings done by the Apaches on the rocks. And it was really nice. And I started to get this feeling for it, this feeling. But then there's another thing that happened. Another thing I'm revealing for the first time, that although I was trying to be a scientist, I had this kind of eccentric nature and was open to these strange things like astrology. And somehow I went to see a guy that did Reiki. I thought Reiki was like this weird, far out, new age thing. I didn't want to do it. But a friend recommended it. And the guy that did it was a medical doctor. So I figured, hey, he's a man of science, right? And he also did it for free. So I'm like, okay, I'll try it. So I go in for my first session. He tells me to take off all my metal. Apparently it interferes with the chi. He says that Reiki is basically a process of opening the channels of chi in your body. And that presumably heals problems. I thought, okay, I'll give it a try. Take off my watch, put my phone on a counter in the clinic. He used his clinic. He was a doctor at a community health clinic on Sundays. He would be there, and I would go there, knock on the door, and he would let me in and go back on the table. I lie down, and it's like a massage. I hey, this is not too bad. And he presses on my navel, and it was like he hit a funny bone in there. It hurt. It hurt. And I'm lying there thinking, okay, he's a doctor. He took the Hippocratic Oath. He's not going to injure me. I didn't want to tell him it hurt because my ego would not let me tell him it hurt. So then he told me to flip over onto my stomach, and he worked on my back, and then he was done. He worked on my head, and nothing hurt. My hair looked like I just got out of bed, but nothing hurt, and that was the end of it. And then he said, your father and your sister came to me. When I was a boy, I had a sister that was a mother figure to me. I was the youngest of four children, and she was 15 when I was born. And for some reason, I really connected with her. We really were close, really close. And when I was five, she was killed by a drunk driver. And it was a very difficult experience, very difficult. It was the beginning of this closing down and disconnecting from the spirit. And my dad and my sister showed up. I'm like, oh, well, that's weird. But I was kind of hooked. So then I went back later, and he said, the whole tribe is here. They have a mission for you. And this is a doctor in Lawton, Oklahoma, that didn't really know much about my tribe. But at the time, I was working to build a casino in New Mexico, which is our tribal homelands, New Mexico and Arizona. And it was a huge project. The tribe had been working on it for maybe 15 years. And I would go to Washington and meet with legislators, and I would go to New Mexico and meet with everybody I could and tell them how important it was for our people to return to their rightful home, the home that they'd been removed from. And when this guy told me that, I'm like, how does this guy know that? I couldn't believe it, but I started to believe it. So I went back again and again and again. The other thing that happened, and this is another thing that kind of opened me up to not just being somebody who's waiting for something to happen, focusing on my breath, waiting for the light to come and being disappointed, was I went on a retreat in Taos. Ramona, you were there, yeah. 10-day retreat, and people were talking about meditating with your ancestors. It never occurred to me, because in Apache culture, you stay away from the dead. When somebody dies, in traditional Apache culture, they would take them up in the hills and bury them in a cliff and never speak about them, and they would burn all their belongings. They would even change the name of their children if they were named after the dead person, because they were afraid they would be haunted by ghosts and ghost sickness can kill you in old Apache beliefs. So I'm like, I would never talk to the dead, never. But it was a very profound retreat for me, and it opened my eyes, and it was like just a couple of weeks after one of these sessions where my ancestors were supposedly talking to me. So I started doing that. So when I would share the merit at the end of a sitting, I would always offer merit to my ancestors. And I would start naming them one by one. And so this practice started to grow. And then I read a book by a former prisoner of war. There were maybe four prisoners of war that went to Carlisle Indian School. A lot of Native people went there, and a lot of them died. But some of them survived, and a number of them wrote books with English or American authors. And one guy wrote a book, and he was talking about how one of the people in his tribe prayed to his grandfather, his dead grandfather. That blew me away. It's like, Apaches don't do that. So I started doing that, started incorporating that into my practice. And and I kept going back to see the Reiki guy, and sometimes he would give me good advice, and sometimes he wouldn't. And so I would practice, and at the end of the practice, often at the very beginning of the practice, I would pray to my ancestors again, saying them by name, from my dad all the way up to my great-great-grandfather, well, and then his great-grandfather. There's some gaps in between. We don't know them all, but I know a lot of them by name. And that was my practice. Nothing really happened. But then in July of 2019, I went back to see this guy again, this doctor. He said, your father came to me. See, before it was the chiefs that came. And it was the tribe, and they were telling me what they wanted me to do. But this time it was just Dad. He said, you're on a vision quest. And that there's a cave near a creek. And inside that cave, there's an object for you that will help you on your path. And he said, do you know any place by the wildlife refuge like that? In Oklahoma, there's a wildlife refuge with big granite rocks. I'm like, no, that's, I don't know any place like that. And besides, that's Comanche land. That's not our land. I have no reason to go there. And he said, well, there were big flat granite rocks. And I'm like, boom, Cochise Stronghold, place I've been with Donald Rothberg. I took pictures when I was there with Donald. I pulled out my phone and I showed him to the guy. He's like, that's it. He'd never been there. So a month later, it's a long drive. It's a 16-hour drive from my home to the Cochise Stronghold. And a month later, the president or the chairman of the White Mountain Apache passed away. He was in his 90s, I believe. He'd been there for 50 years and had been a friend. So that was an excuse for me to drive to Arizona. And I went to his funeral. And then afterwards, I went down to the stronghold. And I met this guy, Randy, who lived on the tribe's land as a caretaker. And Randy, I'm looking for a cave near a stream. So we hiked up this wash, jumping over these big boulders, and we came up to the top of one, and there was a hole in the ground. He said, I think this is the place. And I go down in the cave using my iPhone as a light. And a stick I found to dig, and I'm digging in the dirt. Where is it? Where's the thing I'm going to find? You know, I shared this with a friend of ours, who's Native and Buddhist also. And she talked about a time when she was told to find an object, and an eagle feather fell to the earth in front of her. I'm like, where's the eagle feather? Where's the turquoise? Where is it? All I found was a button from a pair of Levi's. I have no idea how a button from a pair of Levi's got into a cave, but it was there. So then I went to another spot. I'm digging. I could smell the dirt, and I was coated in the dirt. And I get out of the cave, empty-handed and sad. The caretaker moved back to where he was staying. He gave me a big crystal he'd found. in this canyon, and I drove home, and that was it. And I kind of forgot about it. And then 2020, I graduated from teacher training here. It's a big thing. And there's a little retreat center I discovered in the Stronghold. It really doesn't have much in the way of retreats these days. But they have a couple of cabins. And one of the things I wanted to do after graduating was take a long retreat. And with COVID, you know, there just was no opportunity to take long retreats. And Spirit Rock was closed in March, but I've always taken long retreats in March. So I thought about going out there for March, in March. In December of 2020, the person working there called me and said, "Hey, we have some people who are on solo retreat." And they go, they rent one of the, they have two cabins and some tents, and some people were there renting cabins, and they asked me if I'd come out and teach. And basically, I wouldn't get paid except for Donna, but we could stay there free. So I'm like, yeah, that's a chance to check out this Stronghold place. Maybe I can find the cave again. And now this is a weird thing. Since I'm in the story, I'm going to tell you. I went to see this guy one more time, this Reiki guy. And this time he told me the strangest thing I'd ever heard. He said, after we were done, he said, "Who's the white warrior?" I looked at him funny. He said, "Who's the white warrior?" And I said, "Is it me? I've been called a white Apache at times." That's what the people who are full blood will call people like me. And he said, "No, it's you. And it's not, doesn't have to do with the color of your skin. It has to do with your heart, the lightness in your heart." The one thing I didn't mention is my primary practice is metta, loving kindness. So that month-long retreat, when I had that experience here, I had been practicing metta for a month. It's a really incredible, amazing practice. But he said that, and then he said he went to see one person, the original Apache. Again, this is, my skeptical mind is like, what is going on here? The original Apache. And you have a job, your mission now is to reunite the tribe, reunite the Apache people. It'll be hard, but it will be worth the effort. So I put that out of my mind and drove out 16 hours out to the Stronghold, got into a trailer, taught people meditation, taught them to follow the breath, taught them exactly what you're learning here, the practice of being present with your body. And then before I left, there was a lady next door. She's a white person that's really into Native things. And occasionally in the Native world, I run across these people. They're into Native culture and religion, but they're not Native. And she asked me to come see her in a hogan she'd built in the Stronghold. So I went to see her, and we spoke for 3 hours, and she started grilling me about my time as chairman, and asked me why the Chiricahua Apaches at Fort Sill, that's my tribe, and the Chiricahua Apaches at Mescalero, that's a reservation in New Mexico, when our people were released after 20 years of imprisonment, two-thirds of them went to Mescalero, to the reservation there to live, and one-third stayed in Oklahoma. So we were split, and that's what I told her. I said, we were split. The tribe that had lived together, the people that lived together, for 47 years, that they'd been combined and forced on a reservation to live together, were split apart. And we've grown into separate groups, and we just don't see eye to eye. And she said, "I'd like to get them back together. Can you help me? I'd like to offer my land as a place for ceremony." And I said, "Yeah, I'll do that, sure. And when I die, I want to give it to the Chiricahua people. I don't want to make any distinctions between people who are enrolled in the tribes or people who are of Chiricahua descent that are not enrolled in tribes or people who are in the Mescaleros or the Fort Sills. I want this to be a place for all Chiricahua people to come to perform their ceremonies." I said, "Okay, yeah, I'll help you start a nonprofit, a land trust." And then she said, I want to tell you why I asked you to talk to me. I said, okay. She said, I heard you say you were the great-great-grandson of Mangus Coloradus. Mangus Coloradus was an Apache chief also. It was his daughter that married Cochise, which made Cochise my uncle by marriage. So I said, yeah, I was. And she said, well, I the mountains speak to me too. They've been telling me they want their children back. And she said, 18 years ago, I was on a vision quest. And the mountain spirits, those are the names for the deities that guard over our people. They live in the mountains. The mountain spirits came to me and they said, we will help you with your desire. One day, Mangus' son will come and he'll make it happen. And like, wow, tears welled up in my eyes. I just looked at her and said, I'm here. And then, as I was about to drive back to Oklahoma, she said, hey, stop by, we're going to sing some native songs. And I'm like, Because, I mean, the white people singing native songs, we don't really, I would have been embarrassed to tell my friends back home that I sang native songs with white people, but we sang songs. And one wasn't white, she was not Apache anyway. We sang songs for like 3 hours. I had a drum. And at the end, we sang a song, and this lady said, that's the cave song. A cave song? Yeah, deep in the stronghold, there's a cavern. There are two chambers in the cavern. You go in the front chamber, and then you crawl down to the bottom. And you have to belly crawl through this passageway. It's only about 2 feet tall. And you get to the inside, and there's a crystal being there. And this song is the song that we sing for blessing before we go there. And so Maria's like, cave, dad, message. I want that object. So I said, well, when I come back in March to meditate, will you show me the cave? She said, sure. So I went back in March. Now we're going to get to the Dharma a little bit more. And at first I was going to meditate for a month there. And then the place is not luxurious like Spirit Rock. You have to cook your own food. And the closest grocery store is 45 miles away. Closest Whole Foods in Tucson is an hour and a half away. You know, so I spent some time going to Tucson getting stuff. And the first week, and the two people, the caretaker and the lady, took me to the cave. They had not been there in 20 years, and they didn't think they could remember where it was. We hiked up this trail an hour and a half, and then got off on a wash and hiked up another trail, and then climbed up about an 80-foot cliff. And there's this cave. And we go into the cave, down to the bottom, inside, into this chamber. The room was probably about as big as this room. It was like a cathedral. Stalactites hanging down. And this great big stalagmite, the crystal being, 40 feet tall in this room. It was incredible. So I'm like, I'm going to come back here. The other thing I didn't mention is that I said that the mountain spirits lived in these mountains. And the one ceremony we have, it's a healing ceremony called the Dance of the Mountain Spirits. The Apache word for them is Gahe. And by the way, before the Buddha, there were mountain spirits in Asian culture called Yakshas. And it was said that the Buddha had a Yaksha as a teacher. So this kind of spirit is something that is universal around the world. It's not taught in Buddhism, but the Buddha does refer to Yakshas in the suttas. So the mountain spirits live in these mountains. They looked over the Apache people. The story about the dance is that there was a blind boy and a lame boy lost in the wilderness in the mountains. The blind boy was carrying the lame boy who would tell him where to go. And the tribe had left them, and they were hopeless. They sit down in the wilderness, lost. All of a sudden, the mountain opens up. These Apaches come out. They welcome them in. the mountain closes down, and it's like they're in the world, but it's another world, but it's just like this world. And the people take them in, and they feed them, and they heal them, so the blind boy can see, the lame boy can walk. And then for 4 days, they teach them how to paint their bodies and create headdresses, wooden headdresses, costumes. And they teach them a dance. And for 4 days, they have a celebration under the mountains. And then when they're done, they tell the boys, it's time to go back. The boys say, how can we repay you? And they say, you don't have to. This is what we do. Our job is to look after your people. And the way that you repay us is to go back and teach this ceremony to your people so that in times of trouble, do the dance, perform the ceremony, and we will come protect you. So we still perform this dance. I still sing the songs with our dancers in Oklahoma and in New Mexico too. And it's a beautiful thing, and it's a healing ceremony. I think of it as a ceremony of compassion, because it was taught to these young boys that were in a bad way by the spirits that look after us. But the dancers now, the dance groups are handed down generation to generation. And sometime way back in the olden days, it was said that the guys that learned these dances would be out in the wilderness. They'd be running maybe from an enemy. They'd be really, really tired, and they'd lie down in the face of a sheer cliff. And when they were sleeping, they would dream. And these gods would come to them and teach them a ceremony. So that's why each dance group we have will have a different design painted to them that was given to them by the gods, by the mountain spirits, and their own songs that were taught to them by the mountain spirits. So now everybody gets it by the people in the group. But I'm like, I want to get that. I'm out here in the cave. I'm with the mountain spirits. Maybe I can get that too. So after the folks go back from the cave, for the first week, I spent 4 days sitting on a rock pile in this inner chamber, meditating, waiting for something to happen, waiting for Dad to speak to me, waiting for my grandfather, waiting for the mountain spirits. I was also afraid of bears and mountain lions. When we were walking back, after we got back, the guy that showed us the place said, yeah, I saw some bear scat on the trail. So I climbed up on this big rock pile with my back against the wall. It was really a hard place to sit, but I did it. I toughed it out, and nothing happened. Nothing. So after a week, I'm like, well, I think I should do meditation. So I go back to this cabin I rented, and I start meditating just like you. I told some people in the group, my group, this. I thought I could not make my mind stop thinking. Every day, thinking, 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 thinking. For 9 days, the only way I could stop thinking was to say metta. So I said metta. But also I said to myself, I was trying to do a combination, weird combination of like, this kind of practice I developed, which I thought was based on tribal beliefs, it was based on tribal beliefs, and meditation. And so I'd be like, why did you send me out here to find something that's not here? Why am I here? What is the reason I'm here? Answer me, talk to me. Mountain spirits, say something. Nothing, nothing happened at all. Metta, 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 metta. Thinking, thinking, thinking. You know, I really missed, it's the first time I'd ever done a solo retreat. And at night, there's no Dharma talk. And there's nobody, yeah, no stories. Just yourself and your thoughts. And it was hard. It was hard. And what I realized actually, that I was in love with my thoughts, number one. And number two, they kept me company. So I really was getting some insight. But then after 9 days, the cloud lifted and I had some calm. I had peace. And I also got answers. I'm not sure if it's from my own mind or from the ancestors. or from the mountains. I know one thing that I was told during those 9 days was, do what you've been trained. You've been trained to meditate. You've been trained in a lineage, in a practice. Use that practice. So I let go of trying to talk to these ancestors and do what this Reiki guy told me I could do. I let go of it. I just practiced and just paid attention to the sensations of my body and the feelings of my breath. And I would sit outside and look at these magnificent granite cliffs shining in the sunlight and the moonlight. And the Milky Way, so beautiful. You can't see the Milky Way in most places, but you can there. And the quiet, so incredible. And so, yeah, after 9 days, I got answers. And the one thing was, the mountain said, you have to be here. You have to live here. You need to move here to heal yourself. And then to heal your people. And then to heal the land. And then I said, well, what about that object in the cave? And my dad and my Aunt Mill, who was the first chairwoman of the tribe, said, oh, that was just a ruse to get you here. And Dean talked about Indian humor. I don't know if you all remember that. I guess I should go, yeah? Yeah. It was a ruse to get me there. Okay. And then the other thing they said is, don't be in such a rush to get the power. The power will come on its own time. It's like when you first started meditating. So on this first night of your retreat, if you've had monkey mind, or you've had difficulties, and perhaps, I hope none of you are as frustrated as I was on my first retreat because I thought I was going to get it and nothing was happening. Just realize that this process unfolds at a schedule that's beyond our grasp, that's beyond our control, but it does unfold and it happens. It happens. So yeah, I've then basically after that in March, I got involved with the retreat center some, but also I found a cabin. There were 8 cabins in this canyon. Only 3 of them have been sold in the last probably 10 years, and 2 of them were because the people that lived in them died. There's very little turnover. It's really cool. It's a canyon in the middle of a national forest with these little carved out pieces. And so there was a vacant one with a guy died a couple of years ago and his heirs who lived in Phoenix were taking a long time to get it done. But then there was another one next door. And I was thinking about moving out there and I was looking at a condo in a town about 10 miles away. And it was a really rundown little condo, but there weren't any rental properties out there. And I told the realtor, you know, I'd really love that cabin. And she said, well, that's funny because the guy that owns it just called me. It's available. The guy that lived there was an international yoga teacher. And so he traveled the world actually teaching people how to teach yoga. And he went to Peru and got stuck there during the pandemic. And when he was there, he met a woman from Switzerland. And they fell in love. And they got married. And he decided to move to Switzerland. I can't figure that out. That's cheetah. It just happened. So I bought this little 960 square foot cabin at the base of this gigantic cliff. And just a couple of days ago, I climbed up this granite cliff. I just seen on Instagram pictures of our ancestors, Geronimo and Naichi. That's Cochise's son. In the old days, black and white pictures from the 1800s. That's what people often think of Indians, Native Americans, that they're from the old days. And sometimes our own people think of those things because that's all we have. In our tribe, to really hold on to from those days. And he was posting about how it was the connection to the ancestors. I'm like, if only he could live here, if only he could be here. And so that story for me, is how I went from not believing anything to uprooting myself and moving 900 miles away from my home, a place I'd lived in my entire community, all based on intuitions that I received after I meditated. And the meditation was only focusing on my body, focusing on my breath. I don't know how it works, and I still don't know if it works, but it seems to work. It seems to work. So, all I can say is keep paying attention, and something will unfold for you as well. Yeah. And if you're ever in the Southwest and you make your way to the Cochise Stronghold, look me up. I'll take you to a cave. Or not. So I don't know how the time is. So it's such a simple practice. Such a simple practice. Paying attention. Science explains how these sensations come from these nerves in our body to a place in the brain that gives us a sense of what's happening. The teachings say it comes from citta, from our heart-mind. I think some things do come from my ancestors, but I don't know. I don't know. But if you keep doing it, you can find what happened, what will unfold for yourself. Thank you. Don't leave yet. I just discovered a poem. It's obligatory to give a poem when you give a Dharma talk, often. And this is one of my favorite. I've read it before. So you may have heard it if anybody's been on retreat with me. It's from Joy Harjo, the poet laureate of the United States and Native American. It's called For Calling the Spirit Back from Wandering the Earth in Its Human Feet. And it's a long poem. I picked it because I was looking for something that talked about listening to your heart. So there are a couple of lines about that, but I love it, so I'm going to read it before we leave. Put down that bag of potato chips, that white bread, that bottle of pop. Turn off that cell phone, computer, and remote control. Open the door, then close it behind you. Take a breath offered by friendly winds. They travel the earth, gathering essences of plants to clean. Give it back with gratitude. If you sing, it will give your spirit lift to fly to the stars' ears and back. Acknowledge this earth who has cared for you since you were a dream planting itself precisely within your parents' desire. Let your moccasin feet take you to the encampment of the guardians. who have known you before time, who will be there after time. They sit before the fire that has been there without time. Let the earth stabilize your post-colonial insecure jitters. Be respectful of the small insects, birds, and animal people who accompany you. Ask their forgiveness for the harm we humans have brought upon them. Don't worry. The heart knows the way through. The heart knows the way, though there may be high-rises, interstates, checkpoints, armed soldiers, massacres, wars, and those who will despise you because they despise themselves. The journey might take you a few hours, a day, a year, a few years, 100, 1,000, or even more. Watch your mind. Without training, it might run away and leave your heart for the immense human feast set by the thieves of time. Do not hold regrets. When you find your way to the circle, to the fire kept burning by the keepers of your soul, you will be welcomed. You must clean yourself with cedar, sage, or other healing plant. Cut the ties you have to failure and shame. Let go of the pain you're holding in your mind, your shoulders, your heart, all the way to your feet. Let go the pain of your ancestors to make the way for those who are heading in our direction. Ask for forgiveness. Call upon the help of those who love you. These helpers take many forms: animal, element, bird, angel, saint, stone, or ancestor. Call your spirit back. It may be caught in corners and creases of shame, judgment, and human abuse. You must call in a way that your spirit will want to return. Speak to it as if you would to a beloved child. Welcome your spirit back from its wandering. It may return in pieces, in tatters. Gather them together. They will be happy to be found after being lost for so long. Your spirit will need to sleep a while after it is bathed and given clean clothes. Now you can have a party. Invite everyone you know who loves and supports you. Keep room for those who have no place else to go. Make a giveaway, and remember, keep the speeches short. Then you must do this. Help the next person find their way through the dark. We're done now. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.